I would imagine the furthest anyone has traveled to come here to camp is from England, isn't that correct, David? We have one young man, David McBride, from all the way from England. We're not certain now whether or not he is going to be able to arrange a visa, but in the summer school, which is upcoming in another couple of weeks, we have one of our people coming all the way from the Philippines, and I believe one or maybe two coming from Australia. So we will have quite an international representation, not as many as I wish it could be, but that will come eventually in the long term. I think all of you are quite well aware of what has been happening on these grounds. It's obvious because here you are in a building where only a few years ago we were telling our very first campers down here in the dust and the heat and the humidity of East Texas. Next year, when you come back, we will have, hopefully, God willing, an air-conditioned building with an indoor basketball court, and we will have some air-conditioned spaces for at least the girls to be able to get indoors in the air conditioning. But, you know, I have never yet heard of a name like paraphernalia. That is a really strange girl's name. I've heard of Ophelia. There was an Ophelia in the class that I, in the school where I was in high school, but paraphernalia is going to be sleeping right here. I'm just kidding. There may be a paraphernalia out there. That may be a girl's name. But when I think of what's been accomplished, for only a few years ago, we would drive back and forth, and there was this abandoned RV camp here with the rocks all breaking down there. And one day we discovered that it had been in the hands of a bank and that the FDC had gotten a hold of the bank when the bank went belly up, and we did a little investigating, and lo and behold, this property was available. A lot of you were here on that very first field day where we had a lot of the local brethren from around the area to come out here with their mowers, and we took a picture of about 8 or 10 of them sitting on their riding mowers and pushing mowers, and we had an all-church-wide work party to start cleaning up. It was infested with fire ants. It was a complete mess. But now when I look at what's been accomplished in such a short period of time, it's really fantastic. I was able to spend the last few moments preparing the last finishing touches on what I wanted to talk to you today about today in my beautiful new office overlooking the lake. Mr. Gross was in his beautiful new office, and I get thinking about what we're going to be seeing on these grounds 5 or 10 years from now. And I would like to talk a little bit about that, because back in 1978, when I first was forced to move here to Tyler, south of Tyler, I had only a few months earlier given a banquet up at Ambassador College Big Sandy for a very large number of people, quite prominent people, all over East Texas, including the mayors of several towns, including two different county sheriffs, including the chairman of the boards of all of the leading banks, including the presidents of both TJC and Kilgore Junior College. And there were quite a large number of people there because we were in the process of announcing that Ambassador College was going to reopen over here in Big Sandy, after it had been closed down for about 2 years at my father's orders, and that not only was it going to reopen, but we were going to consolidate the two colleges, and a large number of faculty and staff, about half of them, would be transferred from Pasadena to Big Sandy, and we were going to solidify and bring all of the student body over here, where I had the dream of becoming someday a small university. I wanted to see a school of nursing, a school of dentistry and a dental technician, a school of computer programming and all of that type of activity. I wanted to see a flight school, which we already had in place, and where people could become automotive mechanics. We had quite a transportation department. We wanted to expand it. We also wanted to have a school of law, and eventually we wanted to have several thousand students. We knew we could grow to 3, 4, 5 thousand or more, because the sky was the limit so far as the available acreage for expansion, and so far as any restrictions on certain building codes that might curtail that kind of building within a city, as we had experience in Pasadena. Well, one of the nails in my coffin, and I've explained that in the booklet about the origin and history of the Church of God International, so I won't belabor it here, was when I revealed in that message to those people, and later on in a personal in the worldwide news, that I was going to seek local financing for local building programs using local builders, local East Texas businessmen, and that I was going to separate the financial statements of Ambassador College and the Worldwide Church of God. certain parties deep within the financial structure of the Worldwide Church of God didn't like me saying that I was going to separate those two financial statements and then go get lines of credit with local Longview and Tyler banks to begin our building program on the Big Sandy campus. That's all history now. But it was a very short period of time before I was suddenly over here in Tyler starting all over again at age 48. Now, some of the men who were up there, including a multimillionaire who has since died, Mr. Waddy or Watson Wise, had bequeathed quite a bit of money, donated money while he was alive and left money, I understand, to TJC and other institutions. He built the Wise Library. He built, I believe, a large science building. I believe several other buildings, I forget, but they have his name on them, up on the TJC campus. In a grandiose gesture, after making a speech to the president of the Cotton Belt Railway and all these chairmen of the boards of the leading banks of this area, he reached in his pocket, I shall never forget, and pulled out an envelope and said, "President Armstrong," because I was president of the college at that time, "I want to hand you this scholarship, this check, as a president's scholarship for deserving young people, for one student at least per year, to come who cannot afford an Ambassador College education." He stood there and he waxed eloquent about these bright, decent, respectful, good-looking young American men and women who were coming to Ambassador College as an absolute perfect example of the kind of young people all of those people from these surrounding communities would like to see, and talking about the marvelous job that Ambassador College was doing. And I thought it was fantastic for him to do that. Obviously, what he was trying to get across was, I am coming across with some money for Ambassador College to set up a scholarship fund. You should do the same thing. Well, as I said, I ended up here in Tyler at age 48 having to start all over again. It wasn't long before I got a call from Mr. Waddy Wise. He invited me down to the Petroleum Club that was in the top floor of a building that has long since been destroyed in downtown Tyler, and they've moved to a new building now. And present were all of these same people: the president of the Cotton Belt Railway, the various mayors, the chairman of the boards of banks, and a lot of other people that I knew. Woody Brookshire was there, who long since has committed suicide because of ongoing cancer and blindness, who owned with his brothers the Brookshire chain of grocery stores. And they wanted to know, what are you going to do? What is your purpose, your plan, your program? We understand you are relocating. Well, they had no idea what I had in support behind me, how many people might be involved. I remember being contacted by the Central Tyler Post Office, and they asked me to come down and sit down and talk to them, which I did. Well, when I gave that brief talk at that luncheon at the Petroleum Club to this 100 so people of the leading lights around these various communities, I told them exactly what had happened in a very short little vignette. Told them I was having to start all over from scratch, and I told them in three categories my present plans, my long-range plans, and then I said in my long-range plans are my hopes and dreams. And I read to them from the founding documents of the Church of God International and what I hoped would someday become an academy or a college of higher education. In the area of my immediate plans, I said I wanted to locate an office. I was going to immediately go on radio, eventually television, and we would staff that office as we had people who would come on board, and we would begin to provide literature, which I was going to have to start to write, and I was having to start all over again. That was in probably June of 1978. Very shortly, we did find a little building up on the South Loop that was brand new, just newly completed, had never been occupied, and we were able to lease it. Before that time, I was operating out of my little kitchenette, and I remember the very first checkbook for the corporation that I had, and remember calling from my own kitchen, WOAI, to talk to a man that I had met years earlier down there to get radio time on station WOAI. Well, that's all history now, and we can go back over that at some time, but that's not essential. We grew to be 54 radio stations strong before finally opting for television, and we got on television. And eventually we moved to a new facility that we leased, a brand new building up on the central part of South Broadway, And I kept driving back and forth across an area that was desolate and clear outside the city limits, and I saw an old sign in an old homestead that had long since broken down entitled for lease or lease purchase, and I finally wanted to know what that property was worth. The man who had bought it for $4,000. I think we bought it for $16,000, I forget, and we were able eventually to build our own office building. In looking through some of my sermon notes recently, I came across the notes of the inaugural meeting in our own little auditorium in our office building up on South Broadway, and I mentioned how we had grown and that our mailing list at that time was 16,000 people. Well, our donor list is bigger than that by a good bit now, and our mailing list could be, if we had allowed it to grow, well over 1 million, but we keep it very, very active. We don't just send out literature to people who are not reading it, so we keep it hovering around the 100,000 mark. That is not because it couldn't be larger. Those are 100,000 people who are actively involved in our writing back and that we feel are reading the literature that we send them. So a great deal has happened, and a great deal has come along, and a great deal of water over the dam, as we say, or under the bridge from that time. When I talked about those hopes and dreams, I envisioned eventually buildings and a campus. You would be surprised how many times we would sit and talk about whether or not we would acquire some of those houses behind us, that building that the Broadway carpet people had right beside us, Terminix, and the other properties right down along Highway 69, and whether or not we would expand and become a campus right where we were. I won't go back and bore people who know nothing about it, about the many doors upon which we knocked, including a piece of property over by where I live, another piece of property way down the lake on the wrong side of the lake with the little old farm roads for access, and all the things we tried to do over a period of years, and every single time we knocked on those doors, the doors remained firmly shut. It was just not going to work out. We could not acquire that property. When this property became available, it just seemed like things fell into place one after another. And this property was acquired, and lo and behold, here we are in a building which is not so much as a barn, finished a little more nicely inside than a barn, but with wooden supports and wooden trusses and with a metal roof and metal sides that was built for a very little amount of money, in dollars per square foot, a shocking amount, a small amount of money. And now we see this beautiful office building just in the last moving in stages, with sod beginning to be put down on the grounds, and we're going to be discussing the shrubbery and the landscaping and everything the first of this week and finishing up very shortly. Now I want to talk to you about hopes and dreams. We're very familiar with Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Well, I too have a dream. Every now and then Bronson James will sing a special song at the personal appearance campaign where I might be, as he did just the other day in Toronto, and that was the very song he sang. It made me think about this a little bit. To dream the impossible dream. Most of you dream. All of you sleep. Some people claim they don't dream, but that's probably because they just forget what they dreamed about or they don't want to share it with other people. Other people, of course, like to write up manuscripts about what they dream about and send it to me. I'm not really into that type of thing. But we have good dreams and we have bad dreams. When I was a little boy, I would fantasize about being a pilot. I would see an airplane go overhead and I would think, oh, it'd be wonderful to fly. And I remember one day when an airplane landed on the regular highway right outside a few blocks from my house. And here came what you call an old tail dragger ragwing, a little, you know, biplane in those days. The guy that owned the old motorcycle shop had this airplane and he landed it on the highway, just turned it around on the highway and took off again. Well, I was so excited I couldn't pedal my bicycle down there fast enough. And then I remember the day when the drone of huge big radial engines came overhead and I grabbed my bike and I went pedaling up to the Eugene Airport, kind of up on the foothills from Eugene, Oregon, and there were three great big Grumman Avenger torpedo planes, naval torpedo bombers of the early World War II era. And you talk about exciting to a kid. Never could I have dreamed that at age 16 I would be able to get in and to sit in a tandem single-engine aircraft and to have the pilot say, would you like to fly it? And that would turn out to be Tex Rankin, who was a World War II pilot who shot down enemy aircraft and became a flying circus practitioner who went around the country doing aerobatics and all that type of thing. And that really got me turned on to flying. Nor could I have guessed that I would have an opportunity to fly a little bit in the Navy with my section leader, nor would I begin to guess that eventually I would be flying single and then multi-engine aircraft and finally end up flying 68 different types of aircraft and 11 types of jets and to fly the Falcon jet for almost 9 years back and forth across the Atlantic, all over South Africa, North Africa, all over the Middle East, and down to Central and South America as far as Buenos Aires and down all over the world in a sense, although the Falcon jet didn't have the range to go to Australia without taking the long way around through Japan and the Kuriles, so we didn't do that. Little could I have imagined that I would be sitting up there looking down on the fjords of Iceland from 39,000 feet out the cockpit of a jet aircraft when I was in my early 40s, and that I would be type-rated in a fan jet Falcon. Some of the things that I dreamed about never came true. They were pretty limited, pretty short range. I wanted to someday own a white horse. I wanted to be a fireman. I wanted to be a policeman. I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer and design exciting aircraft. None of that ever happened. The last thing in the world I ever dreamed about being, the very last thing I ever dreamed about being, is what I became. A minister, a speaker, a preacher on radio and television. Never remotely occurred to me I would ever be doing something like that. So some dreams come true and some do not. But as all of us grow up, especially when we're in that teenage era and period of our lives, we have these innermost yearnings, these unrequited, unfulfilled longings, these aches that we can't quite put words to, these wants and desires, these hopes and dreams. We want to be somewhere else. We want to do something else. We want to do fantastic things. We want to go to interesting and exciting places. Some of you who are from way far away actually think, that shows how much you know, that Lake Palestine in East Texas is an interesting, exciting place. Now, I'm just kidding. It is. It is. I mean, but what's exciting about it is the other kids who were here, let's face it. There are a lot of lakes, and there are a lot of them a whole lot prettier than this, including Ouachita in central Arkansas and Lake Tahoe, which is a jewel in the crown of America, one of the most beautiful lakes I've ever laid my eyes on. But this will do, and it is an exciting place when you come here to be with the rest of the young people. We want to find fulfillment, happiness, reward, success, excitement, joy. We want to be these things, and most people never realize their dreams. Most people just don't quite make it. They always aim for the moon and fall in the mud. It's all frustration and disappointment and failure. That's the way most people live their lives. I want to contrast a couple of people in the Bible, Abraham and Jonah. Surely Abraham could never have dreamed remotely what would happen to him after age 75. In Genesis, the 12th chapter, now we're talking about a man who is already a lot older than I am. I mean, a man who you would think was near death because he was already 75 years of age. And God told him at this late age, you know, I was 48 when I had to start over. Abraham was 75. The Eternal had said unto Abram, get thee out of your country. I wasn't told to leave my country. And from your kindred and from your father's house. Well, I was told to do that, all right. Unto a land that I will show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you, and curse him that curses you, and in you shall all families of the earth be blessed. Here's a beautiful biblical statement. So Abraham departed. Isn't that an amazing example? God said, Abraham, get out. So Abraham departed. You don't find that kind of obedience very often. But in God's Word, you see that example. So Abraham departed, as the Eternal had spoken unto him. And Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran, which is up in what is today Iraq, somewhere in what the Greeks used to call Mesopotamia, meaning the land between the two rivers that is watered by the Tigris and Euphrates River. If you'll turn to the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews, you will read an entire list of the heroes of the Bible whose dreams became visions and whose visions became faith, and whose faith resulted in the realization of their dreams, at least most of the time in their human physical life. You read of Noah, beginning in verse 7, being warned of God of things as seen not yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by which he condemned the world, became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing whither he went. He believed God, and the Bible gives that as one of the greatest examples of faith in all the Bible. Abraham believed God. Just that simple. He believed God. But that belief resulted in action, and he did what God said. He didn't even know where he was going to go, where he was going to end up. But when he finally got there, God said, I will give you all of this land. And it was a gorgeous land. It was not like we think of it today. The land that Abraham saw then would have looked just about like Oregon or Northern California. It was verdant. It was forested. It was a beautiful land that had a very salubrious climate. It was not all denuded of all of its trees, as it later became over the centuries that passed, but was a beautiful country. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tents, tabernacles, temporary dwelling places, with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise, for he looked for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Through faith, Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and they were both elderly people, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, as many or so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. I, most of you, are the seed of Abraham. All of the Arabs are the seed of Abraham. All of the 12 princes of the tribes that we call Arabs are of the seed of Abraham. Not only would we not be here today, but because God had said, in you shall all nations of the earth be blessed, so are all of the third world, so-called developing or emerging nations of the world, blessed in large measure because of the children of Abraham. Now that's a whole subject all by itself. You can go into the arguments about colonialism and the rapacious rip-off of the colonial empires of the Portuguese, the French, the Dutch, the Germans, the English, and so on. Or you can also talk about where India would have been today if the first Englishman from the British East India Company had never waded ashore. And that belongs in another message, or perhaps is left for historians and not for me. But the point is that Abraham, certainly, after God had promised him to have an heir who would become, from that time on, with the grandson who was to come later on, the eponymous ancestor and the progenitor of literally princes who would become kings, who in their own right would become the heads of great nations and great tribes of human beings. Abraham believed God, and he obeyed God. And so that dream was eventually fulfilled. Look at Jonah by contrast. Here was a little bit about Jonah. If you read the book of Jonah, and I'm just going to touch on a few things without turning to that, Jonah was a man who ran from God's call. He didn't want to fulfill God's commission. He thought that what God told him to do was an obnoxious challenge, and he didn't want anything to do with it. And he thought, just as sure as I do it, God is merciful, God is love, and I'm going to go and put myself out. I'm going to go to all these pains, and I'm going to go journeying up there to Nineveh. I'm going to be away from my home and my family. I'm going to sacrifice. I'm going to work myself down to a nub. And the minute I get there and start saying, if you don't repent, God is going to get all of you. God is going to forgive them, and I will have done it for nothing, and I'm just not going to do it. So he went down to Joppa and found the first tramp steamer, except it wasn't a steamer, it was a sailing boat, that he could jump aboard, and took off and tried to run from the calling of God. Well, he ran. We know what happened. Big storm came up, and they took lots and decided somebody out here, like the jinn, you know, has got a curse on him, and we got to find out who it is. Well, Jonah fessed up and said, go ahead, throw me overboard. At least you can save yourselves. So they tossed him overboard, and a great fish, it could have been a huge grouper, we don't know. It was not a whale. Most whales have a throat about that, you know, very much smaller than a man, and eat krill and little tiny microorganisms, many of them are the baleen-type whales. Whether it was a whale or not, the Bible doesn't say. It says God had prepared a very large fish. And so Jonah ends up in the belly of a huge fish, and from that figurative place in Sheol, he cries out to God. Well, the fish vomits him up, he goes ashore dragging seaweed and the stench of a fish's stomach, and starts telling the Ninevites, in so many days, God is going to destroy this city. Sure enough, God had mercy on the city because the city repented. The king called a fast, said even the animals should fast, and God forgave them, spared their lives, preserved that kingdom, that city-state for a certain period of time. And Jonah sat down, and you've read the story, up on a hill, and sat there with his chin in his hands, waiting for the place to burn up, waiting for God to destroy it, and then thinking of his pitiful state. He was a homebody. He didn't like big tasks. He didn't like God's calling or God's commission. He didn't like to take trips. He believed in justice. He believed everybody ought to get theirs. When you do it, you ought to pay for it. He saw God's mercy as a negative part of God's character, because just as sure as you preach to the dirty, rotten so-and-so's, God's going to forgive them. And that made him mad, so he saw God's mercy as a negative part of God's character. He was a complainer. He said on the boat, he said to God, "You may as well kill me, I'm going to die anyway. It's too hard, it's too difficult, it's too far, I don't want to do it. It's too great a sacrifice, I don't want to do that, this is too difficult. You may as well just kill me right now, I'm going to die anyway." He didn't like people, couldn't stand people, he was a loner. But he loved castor bean plants. He was a gardener. He could walk out and look at a beautiful little plant. "Oh, I love you, plant." I mean, he was so thankful for that big old castor bean. He could sit there. "It's a beautiful plant and shading my bald head. And it's cool where I am." And the plant grew up in about one day and one night. He just loved the castor bean plant. But he didn't like people very much. It took the threat of imminent death, together with a slimy feel, I don't know what that would feel like, the inside of a huge fish's stomach, plus the stench of other rotting fish in there, to get Jonah to decide, "I really don't want to die. And if I do die, I don't want to die here, and now, and in this way." So he began calling out, "Oh God, save me! I'll do whatever you want me to do." Well, that was fine, but that was kind of one of these halfway measures, like another king who merely said, "Well, if I can just have peace in my time, it doesn't matter what happens to all of my children, my sons, my daughters, just give me 15 more years while I'm alive, just extend my life 15 years, turned his face to the wall, bawled, "Oh, please God, just save it while I'm here, just give me 15 more years." So God did, he had 15 more years, and then after he died, at the end of 15 years, all of his children died under horrible circumstances, the nation went into captivity. The guy was so selfish, he just wanted to cling to 15 more years of this life. So Jonah, in a way, was afraid of death then, there, and in that manner, but on the other hand, he told God, "Go ahead and kill me." Well, when God gave him respite, and the fish vomited him up, he was all right for a little while, and then when it was all over, and he sat on the hill and saw that Nineveh was going to be spared, he got mad at God. And God said, "Are you right? Are you correct? Is your heart right to be sitting here all angry? Do you well to be all angry like this?" "Yes, I do well," Jonah said. "I deserve to be angry." There's quite a lesson in the book of Jonah. What a contrast. His motives were not right. He threw his heart into preaching a message of dire retribution because he wanted those people to get it. He wanted them to suffer. I don't think Jonah threw his heart into his message because he wanted them to repent, or he wouldn't have reacted so negatively when they did. He was not a great humanitarian. He did God's bidding, but he's not the example of the kind of person God really would prefer to do his bidding. He didn't believe in a great humanitarian cause. Do you? Let me follow along with you in a ridiculous series of questions. Is there a God? Now, I'm saying ridiculous tongue-in-cheek. Is there a God?
Yes.
I believe there is, and I think you do. You wouldn't be sitting here today. Did Jesus Christ build his church? Yes. That church, which is a spiritual organism and not a political organization, is made up of many branches, plural. It's made up of scattered individuals, some of whom don't even know each other. Are you a member of and a part of that true church? Not one political organization that people have had drummed into their heads for decades, but one true group of called out ones who are connected directly to Jesus Christ of Nazareth. I will say cheerfully the answer to that is yes. What is the hope of this world? The disintegration of communism, the power vacuum of Eastern Europe, the dividing of the Black Sea and the Mediterranean, the other part of the Russian and the Ukrainian Navy into two separate navies? Is it the diminution of atomic stockpiles? Is it cleaning up toxic waste dumps? Is it electing a former pot-smoking hippie anti-war demonstrator to the White House? Is it, you know, I mean, there are other dreams of mine that I never suspected would come true. When I was flailing away every single day on radio during the so-called hippie era about all of the things that were going on in the United States in the early 1960s, it never remotely occurred to me that one of those guys would become the president of the United States. That's the last thing that ever occurred to my mind in 1960, 63, when President Kennedy was assassinated and so on. Never would have dreamed it was possible. So, to a series of questions, what is the only hope for the very preservation of human life on this planet? Now, let me propose something absolutely preposterous to you. Since I used to be part of an organization that had as one of the absolute focal points of its very reason for being, its raison d'etre, its reason for even existing, that my father and I hammered into our people's heads year after year, was that it was a great cause, a great calling, a great humanitarian work to preach the gospel of the kingdom of God as a witness and a warning to as many people as possible before a period of time called the Great Tribulation and the Day of the Lord should come along to take literally hundreds of millions of human lives, that World War III would erupt, there would be nuclear exchanges, nuclear winter, massive droughts and famines, floods, typhoons, hurricanes, nature itself writhing in turmoil as if in some protracted cataclysmic agony of nature itself reacting to all of the stimuli that were happening elsewhere in the political and the geopolitical arena. And for literally years we talked about the five separate methods by which humankind had finally come to the place of having the capacity to annihilate all of human life, not the least of which is botulinum toxin, not the least of which is the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And now we are even finding in special reports after the Official Secrets Act passed and people have been able to get into governmental archives that even the government was experimenting with LSD and with thinking of raining down LSD on whole cities to disorient the populace as well as the soldiers of another nation, and may have literally done so in a couple of test cases in towns in the United States of America. And it was all covered up and no one ever knew about it. Well, we still live in that same world, and if you think because our media and our politicians are constantly telling you we're the only remaining superpower, you better think again. Not one of those great big Russian missiles, not one of them has been dismantled or given to somebody else or stored someplace else. I was reporting way back in the late 60s and the early 70s that South Africa had the bomb. There was absolute proof through satellite technology that they, in concert with West Germany, had developed low-yield nuclear devices and had tested them in the remote South Atlantic Ocean. I told our audiences way before Nixon got on the telephone at that time with Brezhnev and they called a halt to the Yom Kippur War, when for the first time in all of history, satellite technology was used to track the movements of the Egyptian Third Army, which has broached the Bar-Lev line. and it looked like Israel had its back against the wall and the hotline in Washington, D.C., and this was a conversation that you will never be privy to, but I knew it took place just as much as I knew that when the Scuds started raining down on Tel Aviv, at least a third of the Israeli Air Force was orbiting over downtown Tel Aviv with nuclear weapons in its bomb bays, only waiting for the order to go and turn Baghdad into glass. Well, that conversation that took place in that hotline between Tel Aviv and Washington was that if the Israelis had their backs to the wall and Egypt succeeded in directly invading Israeli territory with Egyptian tank columns, Cairo was going to disappear under a gargantuan mushroom cloud. It was not, but for 15 years later, the media and Israel itself finally started admitting that they possessed nuclear weapons. And I knew it 15 years before anybody reported it. Not because I'm smart, but because God gave me a gift for insight, and in all the materials that I had available to me, because we had a very large news gathering bureau, but it was really global because we had people in our offices, of which there were 22 foreign offices overseas, as well as thousands of members in all kinds of different nations who would actually clip this and that and the other little tidbit from page 22 of the kind of news that doesn't get noticed and send it to us. So we had a flood of information coming in continually that was not normally reported in the American media. So we knew the kind of a world we lived in. Somehow, let me see if I'm missing anybody here. Let me see if I'm missing the point. Since the disintegration of the Soviet Union, most Americans have been lulled to sleep. They don't really see that there are any enemies out there that really would threaten our national security. They look upon something like Mogadishu as a sort of an exercise. It's kind of fun, you know. We try to get the warlord. And Rush Limbaugh saying, well, we don't need to go over there and bomb. Just go ahead and show up with a camera and a microphone and grab him. I mean, he's there for an interview for the media all the time. We look upon what's happening in Bosnia, a little token commitment of a few people in Macedonia, which could actually get the Turks and the Greeks very angry, and which could widen that war in the Balkans. And after all, World War I started in the Balkans. And it could widen into a greater conflict. And it could bring in some of America's NATO partners, all of whom are in concert together and some of whom have nuclear weapons. Now, I'm not going to go into geopolitics. I'm merely trying to get across a point involving a mindset. My preposterous questions lead us to ask the question, since the parent organization has abandoned the Israel identity truth, since the parent organization has abandoned any emphasis at all on prophecy, to whom falls the responsibility for completing the work? Upon whose shoulders devolves the responsibility for preaching a message of witness and warning to all of our people and to the world in general before it is everlastingly too late? Now, why did I bring up these cases of Abraham who obeyed God and Jonah who was satisfied with small creature comforts and given to sleeping through troublous times? Because I think there are people like that in God's church and in God's work. I think that here and there are some Abrahams who are truly imbued with a pioneering spirit and who would still like to put their hand to the plow, no matter how difficult, and do God's work. I think there are others who would really prefer to just sit where they are and enjoy the moment and let it soon be over. We used to call them tired old Christians who were just waiting it out. When I see individuals who get a special little doctrinal hook that say, we ought to keep the Passover a few hours after Garner Ted and all those CGI people are, so follow me! I will be your leader! Or we get somebody else who says, now, you shouldn't count from the weekly Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread to the Sunday after the seventh Sabbath. You should count from, and you, we're the seven, six. Follow me, I will be your leader. And so there are a whole bunch of them. And they've jumped off the lifeboat, and they're paddling around in a little rubber kayak somewhere with a string of people with little Mae West bobbing in the ocean, going off in no certain direction. I absolutely could weep over the incredible proliferation of nonsensical effort, of the incredible decentralization of any powerful effort to preach God's word, of the eruption, and I think that is an appropriate word, like so many mushrooms all over this country of little would-be works of God everywhere with a different name of a different leader, every one of them some egocentric would-be little leader that wants to have his name on everything, and some of them take the title Pastor General. I hereby announce I am Pastor Private. Private Pastor. My father, you know, had the title Pastor General. I've seen some letterhead. I'm not kidding you. I'm talking about a little church organization that has sprung up, and they're already the Pastor General. Wow. I guess that means there are colonels and majors and lieutenants underneath them and all that. It's unbelievable what I see happening. It's too bad. It's too bad. All of that duplication of effort, which is absolutely so unnecessary, and it makes me wonder, what does God think about it all? All of these egos waiting to be satisfied. All of these people who would lead a different group off in a different direction, and many of them claiming to believe essentially the same thing. But they do not wish to be together to do an important work for Almighty God. I want to show you an example of someone who perhaps could never have dreamed the way his life would turn out. But he was a young man who knew that at lambing time you had to get your hands dirty. And if you've ever herded sheep, you know what I'm talking about without me getting very, very grotesque about it, of helping the ewes deliver the lambs. It was a young boy, and you know who I'm talking about already, who was out keeping a flock of sheep, and some of the responsibility that devolved upon him had to do with protecting the sheep from wild animals, and his name was David. When Saul had proved himself absolutely disqualified to be the king over Israel, you read in the 16th chapter of 1 Samuel of how the Eternal told Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing that I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Go fill your horn with oil, and I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons." Now, we could go on and on, and I preach sermons about David as a boy. He may have played the harp, and he may have dreamed sitting on a rock looking out over the sheep as they were lying down, listening to some of them, out there in the wilderness somewhere, about someday I'll do this or I'll do that, just like I wanted to be a fireman, I wanted to be a pilot, I wanted to be in the military, I wanted to design supersonic aircraft, or whatever boys dream about or girls dream about. I think girls used to dream about falling in love, getting married, and having babies. Now they dream about being the head of a great corporation or becoming the president's wife and revising health care, whatever. But a whole different thing there for young girls today to dream about than there used to be when I was a kid, and they still wore pigtails and you dipped the pigtail in the inkwell. But then I'm an anachronism. I'm something that time has passed by. I'm an old fossil, as anyone of 16 will tell you. That's not really true, but I'm just saying that. But David could not have remotely have dreamed of where he would go, what would happen to his life. Samuel thought that Saul would kill him. He said, "Why? How can I do this?" God said, "Don't worry about it. Go do it." And so he went and he told them that he wanted to look at all of the kids. And in verse 7, it said, "The Eternal said unto Samuel, Do not look on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I refused him." This was Eliab, a great, big, tall, handsome young man. "Because the Eternal does not see as a man sees, because man looks on the outward appearance." I remember a woman in New York interviewed on a street interview the media recently about what she thought about President Clinton's program. She said, "Well, I think all the women think he's cute, but I don't know very much about him." I thought, that's it. That's why he's in there. That's part of it. Anybody here deny that? Do you think for 1 minute there weren't literally millions of American women who thought George Bush is an old guy and Bill Clinton's cute? And punched the Bill Clinton box on the voting ballot for that very purpose? Of course there were. Hey, why do you think Jack Kennedy wasn't elected because it was Jack Kennedy. The women of the United States wanted Jacqueline in that White House. Sure they did. There's no question in my mind about that at all. I think history will bear it out. God does not look on the outward appearance. Man does. Invariably, inevitably, always, with both hands greedily, with alacrity, with a fierce, ferocious intensity, we look upon the outward appearance. Go down to the bookstore Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and look at the magazine rack. Look at all those would-be homekeepers Look at all those potential mothers and grandmothers. I'm talking about the magazine covers, the models, the poses, the looks on their face. Or just stay around, if you can stand it, the stomach for it, on Good Morning America some morning when they get to the fashion show. And all these gals build about like my one iron, wearing some slatternly clothing, flapping all over the place, coming out there with one foot crossing over the other one, mincing down. You know, it's absolutely unbelievable. And I'm thinking, what's going on in the minds of these people? What is their goal in life? What are their hopes and their dreams? What do they expect eventually to become in this life? What are they going to be? When I left my house a while ago, I was tempted to roll down my window and say to the girl that was going by in this heat and humidity and a little bit of rain, and again, she was so skinny that her knees were twice as big as her legs, and she was out there with these weights just exercising. I thought, oh, that poor thing has got, what is it, the stuff where you eat, and then you don't keep it down there very long. I'm afraid. I almost was going to, hey, young lady, if you're exercising to take off weight, you better go home and stuff yourself because you're in trouble. I wasn't going to say anything, but it worried me because I thought that is a symptom of something that destroyed, to me, one of the loveliest young ladies with one of the most gorgeous voices, and I had the opportunity to hear her, my wife and I did, twice in person, talented, and that was Karen Carpenter, who died from that same terrible psychosis of a hang-up. Her own mother had told her, you're too fat, and she wasn't fat at all. She was beautifully proportioned, but they actually get a perverse idea in their mind that even when they're skinny, they think they're too fat, and so they don't eat. Well, that's too bad. But we do look at the way our skin is stretched over our face. We will vote for people like that. We will cause people to become multimillionaires, and we, the general public, will ruin their lives. Look at Marilyn Monroe and every other movie star you can ever point to. We wreck their lives, the rabble that we tend to be, we meaning the whole American populace, that are screaming for our heroes and, oh, isn't he handsome, isn't he wonderful, isn't she cute, isn't she beautiful? The songs that portray the same thing, they'll never believe me, the song goes. They'll never believe me that such a creature as you could fall in love with me. I'm certainly going to tell them, but they'll never believe me. The poor dolt, why not? I mean, why write a song like that? It's just unbelievable that anybody could ever love me. Nonsense. It's what's down inside, where the character is. God looks on the inward man, on the heart. Jesse called Abinadab, made him pass before Samuel. Abinadab probably got a little upset with Samuel, and Samuel called him a this. I mean, you know, it could have said that, but he said, God hasn't chosen this. Well, maybe that isn't exactly what he said. This one, maybe, is what he said. Then Jesse made Shammah to pass by. Neither hath the Eternal chosen this. Again, Jesse made seven of his sons, apparently he had about 10 of them, to pass before Samuel. And Samuel said unto Jesse, the Eternal has not chosen these. And Samuel said, are here all your children? He said, well, it remains the youngest, but he's out there keeping the sheep. And Samuel said, go get him, and we won't sit down until he come hither. He was sent and brought him in. Now he was ready. Look at the margin. This is why I, through extrapolation, have always thought that Jesus Christ might have been rusty-haired and freckle-faced, because he is of the lineage of David, and David is a type of Jesus Christ. He is of the seed of Jesse, and this says he was ruddy, and the original Hebrew is he was red-haired. He was rusty, red-haired. Brent, smiling away down there. And withal of a beautiful countenance. Now you can get rid of the smile, Brent. just kidding. Of a beautiful countenance, or it says in the margin, of handsome eyes. But David was a striking, handsome guy, but he was shorter and stockier, and he wasn't anywhere near as good-looking as the brother. So it must have been a good-looking young family. And goodly to look to, and the Eternal said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. And Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brethren, and the Spirit of the Eternal came upon David from that day forward. Then you hear the case where Saul was bothered by an evil spirit, and somebody said, we need to get him someone that can play and soothe him and relax him. And so in verse 18, you read of how one of the servants said, behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite that is, listen to all of these qualifications, cunning and playing, and a mighty valiant man, and a man of war, and prudent in matters, and a comely person, and the Eternal is with him. And that was David. And you know the story. David became the king of Israel. He never could have imagined it. He never could have hoped for it. He never could have dreamed. Others have had their dreams. Anne Frank, if you ever read her diary, had her hopes and dreams as she hid out from the Nazis in an attic in Holland. The dream was never realized because the diary of Anne Frank, as pathetic and absolute, you know, just a painful thing to read, made into a very famous movie, and of course written into a very lengthy and a very moving book, showed what goes on in a young girl's mind who is hiding out as a furtive refugee, knowing that if she is discovered, the very fact she was Jewish, a Jewess, would mean that she'd be hauled off to a torture camp and burnt in one of Hitler's ovens. There are others who have had their hopes and dreams. There was a little boy who grew to be a teenager in Germany, whose father was a very lackluster but a very authoritative figure that had a lot of unbelievably illicit relationships in the family, and there were some uncertain things involving his background. His father was actually merely a low-level customs inspector at a border post. And the little boy finally wanted to be a great somebody, but he didn't know what. But he was a dreamer. He thought he was an artist. He thought he was a poet. And of course, World War I came along, and he had a wonderful opportunity, so he joined the army. And he loved the army, and he loved the battle, and he was wounded, he was gassed, he ended up in a hospital, and he never forgot the thrill it was to be down in those trenches, slogging in the mud, fighting for the rat they were going to cook for dinner, with the camaraderie of the great German soldier. And so he became absolutely imbued with a spirit of vengeance and of hatred toward those that he thought had stabbed the German general staff and the German army in the back, and he wanted to get even. His name was Adolf Hitler. He never could have remotely imagined, as a young teenager before he joined the German army, that he would someday emerge as the dictator of Germany and eventually of all of Europe. There have been a lot of people who have dreamed dreams. If I had told any of you in 1979 or in 1980 that we would be on this property, in this building, with that office building up there, with our television program, with the size of our mailing list, with approximately 100 congregations scattered all over the United States, with other congregations in the Philippines and all over in other countries, with over 55 ordained ministers, with many chartered churches, and with other ministers coming along, with baptisms coming along every single week, you probably would not have believed me. You may not believe me when I share with you some future hopes and dreams. We now have another young group of campers coming in here. Why do you suppose we do that, campers? Just because it's kind of something that we do? We do it because we want to give you a couple of weeks of fun? No, not at all. We do it for all kinds of reasons, not the least of which is we recognize, first of all, that because God's church is a Sabbatarian organization, and because the president of this church happens to be a child who grew up in a Sabbath-keeping home, who knows exactly what it was like in the public school systems to be ostracized and looked down upon, and who also knows that there are, in those years of teenage, desires to meet other young people of like belief, of like convictions, whose parents are in the same organization. But it goes even beyond that. We also hope that eventually, through the classes, through the instruction, through the recreational and the physical exercise and the opportunities you have, that we will be producing character, that we'll be helping you to make wise and right decisions, that we might be able to direct some youngsters' steps away from certain things that are available out here in society, from a premature pregnancy, from involvement in drugs, smoking, or alcohol, and perhaps show you a little taste of what life can be like in a completely different environment. There are a lot of reasons why we do it, and why right now it would have been a lot more convenient for our workers and our office staff and everybody else not to have been bothered with about 67 young people and all the other support people running around these grounds when we don't even have the sod in and the exterior planting and all the boxes aren't unpacked and people aren't even moved into their offices yet. But we are doing it because we believe it must be done, and because we feel it needs to be done for the sake of the young people of God's church. Let me share with you then something that I hope to see in the next few years. I hope to see in the next few years Imperial Academy with a growing campus, with a student center and library, a magnificent, beautiful building with a big panoramic view of that lake, maybe sitting right down here where at the present time my son lives in a mobile home which is soon to be moved away from there. I hope to see a 3 or 4-story dormitory building right over here along that fence perhaps, or up on the back of the property. I hope to see another high-rise building which will be like a combination classroom, library, and student center. I envision at least 4 large major buildings, not the least of which will be a genuine indoor hardwood floor gymnasium and natatorium with a portion of it that can roll away to be inside outdoor, indoor-outdoor swimming for all the students who will come and for the church in general and for the camp when the campers come. That facility will be down on this end of the property and the others will be up at the other end. I have a master plan in the back of my mind. A hope, if you will call it, a dream, if you will allow, that eventually, 6, 8, 10 years from now, there will be a campus developed on these grounds, and who knows how far they will grow. I'll tell you what, the Eternal's hand is not shortened. Now, let me relate a quick story to you. I know that some people have certain attitudes about a man named Herbert W. Armstrong, and I confess I've had my own hurtful attitudes in the past, of which I've had to repent. So far as being the judge of his character, I am not. But I will recite a time when little Shirley Hammer, who was back here, who was my wife of more than 40 years, and I were having a very rare date when I came over here to drive my father and her father over into some old thickets and some grounds out about 2 miles east of Big Sandy. My dad and her dad and her older brother Buck climbed over an old rusty barbed wire fence and disappeared into a wooded area with little post oak so thick you could hardly have disappeared from sight in about 30 yards. My father came back talking about this tabernacle he wanted to build. Well, I was just newly out of the Navy, and I said something to him a little bit crass. But I said, Dad, you haven't got enough money to build a third-rate outhouse, and you're talking about building a tabernacle. That was how imbued with a vision I was at age 23 in 1953 on the grounds of what eventually became Ambassador College Big Sandy, and I eventually became its president. Don't let anybody tell me that what I'm telling you about what can happen on these grounds can come true. To dream the impossible dream, what is impossible with God? Nothing is impossible with God. I envision a campus someday that will be turning out not just 22, 23, 25-year-old graduates, but to which young couples in their 30s and 40s can come, to which retirees in their 50s and 60s can come to get a diploma, to get an education, and can go out from here to serve in every branch and every aspect of God's work there is, not only to become pillars in local communities and local elders and administrators of local churches and with other regional youth programs and activities for God's people, but also to be inducted into Christ's ministry and to become pastors of churches. In the mind of a gentleman named Ronald L. Dart is a vast storehouse of biblical knowledge and information and the ability to teach it and impart it. In the minds of all of the rest of us, the very same storehouse of information and the experience of all of these years is there. It needs to be given. It needs to be imparted. I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to 2 solid weeks of about 42 men and women who will come here and be in this building and will be taking classes on a regular schedule right on through 2 solid weeks of everything we can possibly build into a curriculum in a summer program, which will be the first go-around to kind of get our feet wet about a regular curriculum of classroom study for Imperial Academy. You might sell me short. Just don't sell God short. Give it another 10 years. You won't recognize the place.